I feel like introducing this as welcome to the next edition of the Religious History Channel. Because after our studies today, we are going to be looking at an awful lot of history and how it all interacts with our New Testament text. I'll just hand you a bunch of leftovers. Also, John and Nancy, by having you guys move on that side, I feel like I'm in London, on the wrong side of the road. All the signs. No, you don't have to move. I'm kidding. Oh, gosh.
Okay,
finally.
We're going to move because I hear a little bit.
The stop signs and everything else are on the right side of the road now. Okay, good.
Yeah, everything is right.
Everything is right now. I can teach. Wow, I was worried for a minute.
We're happy here.
Oh, you're fine. I'm just teasing you. Anyway, you know, they should hand out wood-burning sets to everyone who sits in the congregation so we can carve our names in the pew where we always sit. So if anyone else comes to say, that's my spot, and you can prove it. Anyway. All right. You can see from our text that I'm giving you where we started a little bit back in the text from last week, starting in chapter 11, verse 19, which we'd already looked at, but we ended before I got to all the material for the day. We had earlier, Peter had gone to see Cornelius, the Roman centurion up in Caesarea, and then he came back and was reporting to the church in Antioch. The Jews there weren't exactly thrilled with him for working with a Gentile like that. But as we can see, it's in the previous verses. They were accepting of his message. But then it says here they were scattered all over, but there was ministering happening from Cyprus and Cyrene. They were all coming to Antioch. If you remember, Antioch is much farther north than Damascus. It's almost in current-day Turkey. It's actually in the northern edge of current-day Syria. And the church was centering itself in Antioch. Verse 21, the hand of the Lord was with them, and a great number believed and turned to the Lord. The report of this came to the ears of the church in Jerusalem, and they sent Barnabas from Jerusalem to Antioch, basically to check out what was going on. He came, he saw the grace of God, he was glad, and he exhorted them to remain faithful to the Lord with a steadfast purpose, for he was a good man, full of the Holy Spirit and of faith, and a great many people were added to the Lord. And then the next verse. So Barnabas, probably feeling the need for a strong leader, strong voice, help in the development of the early church, went to Tarsus to look for Saul. The idea of looking for Saul suggests that he didn't have his address. And he wasn't quite sure where he was, but he knew he was up in the area. He went and found him, brought him back to Antioch, and they were, for a whole year, ministering to the early church there. Wouldn't you be fascinated to know what they did during that year? What were the meetings like? What were the Bible studies that they were carrying? Who was there? We have no idea. We have absolutely no concept. But then it says, the very next part of that verse, and in Antioch, the disciples were first called Christians. Now, it's interesting, apparently in Latin, the I-A-N, technically it's I-A-N-I, extension on a word means a member of. So if you have blank I-A-N, Libertarian. That means you are of the group of the Libertaires or the Libertarians. So you would have the word Christ was just appended with this meaning. So these are identified as people of Christ. That's really all it meant. It became a term that you find it only a couple other times in the entire New Testament. You find it in Acts 26:28, and you find it in 1 Peter 4:16 of other people describing them. We have no record, at least in the New Testament record, of the Christians calling themselves Christians. Isn't that interesting? Not sure what they call themselves. Maybe we're the church or people of the way, or maybe they did call themselves Christians. It's hard to know. We don't have any record of it. But it is interesting that this is the first time. And it became later a very easy designation for those outside of the faith to describe them. You know, we put a lot of labels on things. And I mean, think of Presbyterian and Methodist and Baptist and Mennonite, and we have all these different labels to describe our differences and our separation. But in general, people of the faith today, we call ourselves Christian. That is the word. There's a big hullabaloo right now within certain elements of the Christian church of whether or not to use the word evangelical as a descriptor anymore, partly because of the controversy over support for President Trump or not and all of that mess. I find it kind of funny, because what do you replace the word with? Those people? I mean, when you have a very broad word to define, you can't take the word away and insert something else. One of my clients is the head of the Evangelical Christian Publishers Association, happens to be based here in the Phoenix area, and they're having this question of what do we do with the word evangelical at the beginning of our organization's name. I said, well, if you take the word evangelical off of ECPA, you're left with CPA, which means you're just an accounting firm. You just can't do that. I mean, what do you do? So anyway, that's a complete, not even in my notes, it just jumped in my head, thinking about labels. And I think sometimes the exercise is a little bit unimportant. You know, the bottom line is we are people of faith, people who believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, Savior of our lives, our world, and is the King of glory. Well, the next verses are interesting. You have, now in those days, prophets came down, meaning up, if you're looking geographically, but they came from Jerusalem to Antioch. And one of them was named Agabus. What a great name. I have no idea what it means. It doesn't matter. But he shows up again in Acts 21. He confronts Paul and uses Paul's belt as a metaphor to make a larger statement of the state of the world. But this prophet stood up and foretold that by the Spirit that there'd be a great famine coming all over all the world, which took place during the time of Claudius. And you have to go, who's Claudius? Any ideas? Want to guess? He's the emperor of Rome. But which emperor? Weren't there tons of them? Guess what? You have a chart in the back of your handout. Because I wanted to help you all get a sense of the History Channel here, of where it all fits. We all know about Julius Caesar. He's before this chart begins, because he's before the time of the New Testament. But when he died, he, in his will, named his nephew Augustus as the adopted son and heir of the Roman Empire. It was Augustus who was the emperor during the time of the birth of Jesus. Well, after him became Tiberius. The entire ministry of Jesus was during the time of Tiberius. Then came Caligula, who was well known for his debauchery and his anti-Christian or anti-church sentiments. Then came Claudius. Now Claudius, and I actually wrote some of the stuff in the middle section here. Claudius, there were four major famines during the 13-year reign of Claudius. In fact, in 51 AD, Claudius was almost lynched by mobs in Rome because one of the famines hit Rome, hit the Italian region, and there was no food. They actually find some papyri from 46 AD, which was when the big famine hit Judea. They actually find some scrolls that showed the prices of grain astronomically higher than other papyri were from the previous year. So, go ahead.
You buy it with Bitcoin?
Yeah, there you go, Bitcoin. But you think about it, if there's a shortage, how many of you do your grocery shopping and suddenly you go, wait, eggs are twice the price they were a year ago. What happened? Or some other produce has skyrocketed. Well, supply and demand, it's what happens. Well, the Josephus wrote about the famine in 46 AD in Judea, and it said that there were hundreds and thousands of people who were dying every day for lack of food in the area. Didn't make Claudius very popular. People were blaming the government for the lack of rain, or blaming the government for the lack of planning for the time of famine. It could be, because when I was looking this up, the famines were in, 42, 44, 46, and 51. So they may have had a famine in 42, but it drained all of their resources to cover it. And they didn't have enough time to rebuild before it hit again in another part of the empire. So you had two famines in Rome, one in Greece and one in Judea, that were very well documented and well known. Unfortunately, despite the positive elements of Claudius, he goes down in history as a poor emperor because of the famines. Otherwise, he actually was doing some good things. Now, you notice I mentioned in that column there, he expelled the Jews, including Priscilla and Aquila, from Rome in 50 AD. What you had was, he was sympathetic. He undid a lot of the negative things that Caligula had been doing against the Jews. But the one thing he instituted a limitation to how many of them could gather in one place at one time. I don't know what the number was, but let's say it's 50. So no more than 50 could be in a synagogue at one time. Probably to dispel the problem of creating a million-man march on Rome or something, you know, where they just could not control the crowds. Problem is, the Jews didn't cooperate, didn't like it, and in Rome, they rose up, and so he just banished them all. He kicked every single Jew out of the city. And that's actually mentioned in Acts chapter 18. So we know this history. We know this constant tension between Rome and the Jews. I was thinking about that. Maybe it's just because our study is always related to Rome and the Jews. And I'd probably have to look it up. But I don't read a whole lot of controversy between Rome and Egypt, or Rome and Greece, or Rome and Turkey. You read about certain tiny uprisings, but it's not a people, it's a region. The Jews were in constant battle with Rome. And I believe that part of this can be attributed to the fact that for a long time they controlled Israel under the Maccabees. In that period between Greece and Rome, you had the Maccabeans. They controlled they were their own people. But when they began to lose control, they appealed to Rome for help. And that was their first mistake. And then Rome came in and eventually took over. So there was always this push, which you don't read about, at least not as frequently. And I may be talking completely ignorant. Help me if you know the history any better than I do. But you don't read as much of the consistent century, decades of conflict with a people. You just don't see it. The Jews were a thorn in the side of Rome. Always had been. And right up to this time, you have this tension. So you have this famine in the days of Claudius. Well, on your chart, who succeeded Claudius? Oh, the famous one. And if you'll notice, the third column shows when a lot of the books of the Bible were being written during the time of Nero, because that was during the time of Paul. When we do our chronology, this is, I think I've mentioned this before, but when we come to Acts chapter 15, which is the end of Paul's first missionary journey, we will then begin looking at some of the New Testament letters and books that were written at that time. So we're going to start with Galatians, because he had just visited Galatia and then he wrote the letter to them. So we'll be reading, you know, the history of the movement of Paul and Barnabas through the area, and then we'll read the letter that he wrote to the people he just talked to. But then, because we're not quite sure exactly when the book of James was written, there are those that place it very early and those that place it very late. I'm going to assume it was very early, because you'll have the picture of the book of James talking about works contrasted with Galatians, which talks about grace. And we'll right away see the tension between the two. So we're going to go from Acts to Galatians to James, then back to Acts. That's the plan anyway. So, and you don't have a choice. So, you know, well, you kind of do, but anyway, that's the plan. Because chronologically, that's kind of how it works. All right, back to the text. Because of the famine, verse 29, the disciples in Antioch determined, everyone according to his ability, to send relief to their brothers in Judea. So this is 46 AD, when the famine was happening in Jerusalem in that area. They took up a collection in Antioch. And they built funds, and they handed it. They did so, sending it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. Isn't that interesting? We cavalierly just read over that, going, oh yeah, they were doing that all the time. Well, this isn't exactly a network community that we consider in our own day. This was new. So this was a significant thing for the people in Antioch to help the people in Jerusalem. That's a big deal. Because it's not like they're one city over. This is a 5, 6, 7 day journey. This is a long way. And you couldn't, you know, do a direct deposit or PayPal. That meant putting the money in the hands of trusted people and sending them. So what we have here next is the next part of our passage. We have chapter 12. Now, chronologically, chapter 12 happens before the end of chapter 11. Because the end of chapter 12 has Paul and Barnabas coming and presenting the funds at the end of all of this, all the rest of this happening. So there are some who like to say they call chapter 12 what did I say, an insertion in the record or a picture of what's happening in Jerusalem after talking about what's happening in Antioch. So we've just been up in Antioch. Now we're back in Jerusalem. Chapter 12, it's all about Peter. And it's the last time we will talk about Peter. At the end of this chapter, you know, he shows up as a side note or in conversations a couple more times. But this is it. This is the last time we really see Peter in as the center of the story. Because after chapter 12 becomes Paul's journeys. For the whole rest of the book of Acts. So this is a significant time and moment in the history of the early church. And let's look at it. Because I'm going to do some little more History Channel stuff here for you, as you can imagine. Because verse 1 says, about the time Herod the king, stop. Which Herod? There are six of them in the New Testament. Isn't it confusing? At least it is to me, because they keep talking about Herod as an individual, not realizing it's like talking about Caesar. That it's a title. So it could be anybody. But even at the time of Christ, there were three Herods. I can tell you're confused. And so am I. But we've talked about this before, but I know it just has not absolutely, you know, you didn't have to take a test on it, so you didn't try to memorize all of this. Well, I'm going to do my level best to try to draw up the Herod claim. So you start with Herod the Great, good old HG. Now, you'll notice those dates. This is all very, very early. We figure Jesus was born around this time or so, maybe a little earlier. So between 6 BC and 4 BC, we're not quite sure. And of course, all these dates are approximate, so let's not get too caught up. Now, Herod the Great was this amazing builder. He built Caesarea. He built the temple. He was a Edomite, a heritage. But one of his two wives, Mariamne was the daughter of Simon, the high priest, which meant she's Jewish. So Herod the Great marries a Jew, which makes him very, how should I say, acceptable, at least to a certain level, to the Jewish leaders and the Jewish people. Well, Herod the Great dies horribly, and, you know, basically was insane and starts killing off his sons, partly because they were plotting to kill him and all sorts of other nice, just normal fun family dysfunction. Thanksgiving was always an interesting thing, so who would survive the meal? Anyway. When he died, let me get my Roman chart out to make sure I have it right. My Roman chart has Augustus Caesar as the Caesar of the time, right? When Herod the Great dies. So when Herod the Great dies, here's your handout right there, right behind. There you go. When Herod the Great dies, Augustus Caesar takes all of Israel, because Herod was in charge of all of Israel, and divides it into three parts. So there's one, two, three sons. There is Herod Antipas. There is Herod
Archelaus, and Herod Philip. Right? So he divided it amongst the three. Now he had more than three sons. He killed the other two. One of them was a guy named Aristobulus. All right? But he's dead. So you have these three. Fine. This is all very confusing. I know. Herod Antipas was in charge of Galilee and Perea. Just a reminder, Galilee is here, Samaria is here, Judea is here, right? Perea, is kind of this area. This right here is the Decapolis. They were freestanding people. And then you have this region up here, which is called Iturea. And this area is Syria. Got it. Herod Antipas is in charge of Galilee and Perea. Archelaus was given Judea and Samaria. Good. And Herod Philip was given Iturea. And you wonder, who cares? I don't really care. Well, it's important because even in the trial of Jesus, even though it happened in Jerusalem, he wasn't brought before Archelaus. He was brought before Antipas. Because remember, it said Jesus was from his hometown of Nazareth, which he was in charge of. This is why it's this Herod, not this one. And oh, by the way, this one's no longer even alive. He ruled from 4 BC to 6 AD. He only lasted 10 years. Why? Well, because one of the first things he did is he killed 3,000 Jews on Passover. He didn't like them, so he wiped them out. He just walked in and slaughtered them. The Jews weren't real happy about that. And they made it known to their friends, Antipas and Philip, and said, "This guy's a problem. You need to get rid of him." So, in 6 AD, Augustus Caesar removed Archelaus as the head of Jerusalem and Samaria and put in charge a governor. So who was the governor at the time of Christ's crucifixion? Pilate. So you see how this all works? It kind of all comes together when you have it all kind of laid out like this. And you, by the way, there will be a quiz. And if you don't pass the quiz, you don't get the goodies next week. So it's real incentive for some of you. Okay. Now, you might say, but Steve, none of these are the Herod that you're talking about in chapter 12, verse 1. No, they're not. Because we're now around 46 some odd BC or AD. Aristobulus had a son, and his son was named Agrippa. And Herod Agrippa is the Herod of chapter 12. So where does this all fit? All right. Herod the Great kills his dad. Herod Agrippa and his mom, Bernice, flee to Rome, where he's raised. He grows up in Rome. He grows up in the courts. He learns the Roman system. He really becomes a Roman, even though he is part Edomite and part Jew because of Miriam. He's in this weird place. He's learning the system, and he becomes friends with a guy named Gaius. Gaius later took the name Caligula. You see your Roman emperor chart? So Herod Agrippa is friends with Caligula before Caligula was emperor. In fact, he supported him so much to the point that Tiberius threw Agrippa in jail. He didn't like the fact he's supporting this guy who's making moves on the throne. So Agrippa's in jail in Rome. Didn't know what he's going to do. He backed the wrong horse. And then Tiberius fell over dead from a heart attack. And Caligula becomes emperor. And one of the first things he does, he goes and pulls his friend Agrippa out of jail and went, "Thank you for supporting me all those years. I love you, man. I'm going to put you in charge of Iturea because your uncle Philip has just died." And so Herod Agrippa comes back to Israel in charge of this entire region up here. 2 years later, Antipas dies. Antipas dies, Archelaus dead, the governor. And so Caligula says, "Guess what, Herod Agrippa, my friend? Take charge of the whole thing." Herod Agrippa is now covering the same amount of territory as king as Herod the Great did. So here we are, full circle, almost 50 years later. There is now one Herod who's in charge of it all. This is a big deal in the history of the church and of the history of Israel. I got through that. I actually got through it all. Okay. So we have one man, and of course one guy titled his sermon, "Get a Grip of Yourself." Yeah, I knew you'd like that one. I thought, that's pretty funny. "Get a Grip of Yourself." So who is Herod Agrippa? Is he a friend of the church or an enemy of the church? Well, think about this background. He was very close to Caligula. Caligula has now, on your chart, has died. And Claudius is in charge. Claudius is struggling because of all these famines. And he wants security and consistency in Israel. Then the famine hits Israel. And Claudius is saying, "You just fix it. I know I'm 2,000 miles away, but you're in charge. Take care of it." Well, people are uprising. The Jews are not happy. They're hungry. Agrippa is trying to curry favor with the Jewish leaders, not with the church, with the Jewish leaders, meaning Pharisees, Sadducees, the leaders of the Sanhedrin. The church is a problem to the Sanhedrin. We don't read about it too much anymore. We had the trials of Peter in chapter 5 of Acts. We had some other things, but we're not hearing the tension necessarily, but it's still there. In fact, it's even more difficult because the church is continuing to grow right there in Jerusalem. So, Herod decides, "You know what? I'm going to make these Jewish people really happy with me. I'm going to kill one of the apostles." And that's what he does, right there in verse 1, or verse 2. "Herod Agrippa laid violent hands on some who belonged in the church. He killed James, the brother of John, with a sword." According to tradition, it wasn't just skewering him like a poker stick. It was a beheading.
The only way to do this, though, if you remember, you had to have approval from Rome to kill a Jew. So he had this power. He made the appeal. Of course, they're just going to rubber stamp whatever he wants to do. And you had to have a trial. We don't have any record of the trial. But Clement, one of the early church fathers, in writing about this incident, granted it's almost 100 years later, but the stories were passed on, so there's probably some strength to the story. There was an accuser who was a key witness in the trial of James. This accuser is unnamed, but as the trial commenced, the accuser heard James's testimony, his own statement of who Jesus was, and saw the courage of the man, and the accuser repented and said, I admire what you're doing. In fact, I was wrong, but the trial's, it's too late. You know, it's already been, verdict has been sealed, and James is going to be beheaded. And he says, let me die with you. Quote, on the way to the executioner arena, he asked James for forgiveness. James looked at him for a moment and said, peace be to you, and kissed him. And so both men were beheaded at the same time. So despite all of this, all we have is this tiny, tiny, teeny, tiny footnote. This is significant, my friends, because this is the first apostle to die for the faith. The one of the original 12. His brother is John. At the transfiguration of Christ, who was there? James, John, and Peter. The three of them. James and John had a nickname.
Sons of Thunder.
Sons of Thunder. James is no footnote. We just don't hear a lot about him. He wasn't the beloved. John was the beloved. But he was right there. We even have in Mark chapter 10 where you had James and John coming to Jesus and say, could you put one of us on your left hand and one on your right? And Jesus' answer is said, are you willing? Do you realize you're willing to drink from the same cup as me, the suffering? Well, guess what? James experienced the suffering. And isn't it interesting? The first apostle to die was James. The last apostle to die was John. They bookended the history of the early church when it came to their demise. Well, verse 3. When Herod saw that it pleased the Jews, he went after Peter during the days of the unleavened bread. Now, explanation. So he kills James probably right before Passover, from what we can conclude from the text. Because you can't kill anybody during Passover or during the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, which is after that. 7 days after Passover is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So you have Passover on Friday, and then you have the Sabbath Saturday, and then the next week is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. There's nobody's going to get executed during that time. So they come after Peter. Think of this for a second. Just for total practical, modernistic comparison. You have a very strong group that is starting to make inroads into your territory, and you're a military leader or a political leader. The only way to really knock them off of their growth is to kill their leaders. So he goes after James, and now he's going to go after Peter. Peter is scheduled to die. What would have happened to the early church if Peter died? He's the head. He's the main guy right now. I mean, in the Jerusalem church in particular, this is a big deal. When we read this, we tend to, oh yeah, you know, Peter was arrested, and we focus on the fact that he got out. But if he died, from a human perspective, this is a problem for the early church. So, because he is arrested probably right around or right before Passover and all of this, he's thrown in jail. Verse 4, they seized him, put him in prison. It's the third time we have had Peter arrested so far in Acts. The other two were in Acts chapter 4 and Acts chapter 5. They put him in prison, delivering him over to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending that after Passover, the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, to bring him out to the people. Now, four squads of soldiers. I had never noticed this before. I saw the number four and thought four soldiers. This is four squads of four. This is 16 soldiers. Normally, for a prisoner, you would have one squad of four, and each would take a watch. 3 hours on, 9 hours off. 3 hours on, 9 hours off. So they could rotate someone. Someone would take the 12 to 3 shift in the afternoon and 12 to 3 in the morning. That was the rotation. So 3 hours on, 9 hours off, 3 hours on, 9 hours off. That's usually sufficient. That means you have one guard with one prisoner. Makes perfect sense. This time, it's four on every shift. Four times the security is around Peter. This verifies, in my mind anyway, how important Peter was. And Agrippa knew that. He knew exactly who Peter was. And how powerful of a leader he was with this sect. So, four soldiers intending to kill him after the Passover. So Peter was kept in prison, probably about 8 days. And then, as one guy pointed out, there's a little word right after the word prison that's kind of important. What is that word? But. But. He's in prison. He's going to die. He's been convicted and sentence has been declared. He is going to die. But. Earnest prayer for him was made to God by the church. The word earnest there is the same word that's used of Jesus when he's praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. The same exact word. It's a imperfect tense, which means it's ongoing, it's incomplete, it's constant, and very intense. An earnest prayer was made for him. Ruth Paxson wrote it this way. God does not manifest his glory to the spiritual tourist, but only to the one who comes up to him on the mount. The reflected glory of Moses' face as he came from his 40-day communion with God was not produced by a snapshot, but by a timed exposure. What a great way of saying it. Moses wasn't changed on the Mount Sinai with a selfie. It was a long exposure to God, and it changed the countenance of Moses. So here we have these people praying. They're not just saying over dinner, Lord, please pray for Peter. Hope he's okay. And then moving on. This is fervent and earnest prayer for Peter. That God's will would be done in whatever form or fashion it would take. So verse 6. Now Herod was about to bring him out to kill him the next day, the next morning. So on that very night, Peter was nervous and stomping around, pacing in his cell. Oh, no, it doesn't say that. Mm-hmm. He was sleeping like a baby. But it's, how is he sleeping? He is sleeping with one arm chained to one soldier and another arm chained to another soldier. So he is in chains with between two soldiers, and then there are two others guarding the door. Remember, there are four in that room or cell with him. They are not about to let the Jews come and, you know, sneak him away like they did with Jesus after he died and then made up the whole thing about him resurrecting from the dead. They still remember this. This has not been that long, maybe 10 years, 12 years, 13 years, not that long ago. And the story of Christ's resurrection is the cornerstone of all of the message of the early church. And then behold, an angel of the Lord stood next to Peter, and a light shone in the cell. And even though he turned on the light, Peter was still asleep. I mean, I don't know whether you sleep light or not, but often if someone shines a light in your eye when you're asleep, it will somehow eventually wake you up. But the angel had to nudge Peter. It said he struck Peter on the side. I mean, this isn't just some apparition, there's a physicality here. I'm going, hey, wake up. It's time to go to church. Yeah, my mom did that to me a lot when I was in high school. And woke him saying, get up, quickly. And he says, okay. And the chains fell off his hands. Now, the Roman soldiers are still in the room. This is the supernatural element of what's happening here. Draw the picture in your mind, what you're seeing. An angel appears to Peter, the chains fall off, and the Roman soldiers are still standing there, like nothing's going on. The chains fell off, and the angel says, dress yourself, which suggests he was not dressed. It could have been he was stripped, as a prisoner would be. Or he was put in some sort of prison garb, but his clothes are probably tossed in a corner. It says, dress yourself, put on your sandals, which suggests that he was barefoot beforehand. And he did so and said, now wrap your cloak around you. In other words, get your coat. It's probably chilly outside. It's Passover. It's March. And follow me. And he went out and followed him. And he didn't know that what was being done by the angel was real. He thought it was a vision. I would too. You know, we're walking right past the soldiers and they're just standing there. They're not asleep. It doesn't say anything about them. They're not involved. And when they passed the first and the second guard, they came to the iron gate leading into the city, and it opened for them. And they went out, went along one street, and immediately the angel left him. And Peter came to himself, standing there in the middle of the street now, alone. Kind of probably shook himself a little bit and said, now I'm sure that the Lord sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and all that the Jewish people were expecting. When he realized this, well, where should he go? Well, he goes to the place where most of the believers gather, and that is the house of Mary. Many speculate that this is the place where the upper room visitation happened, a larger house where a lot of people could gather. The mother of John, whose other name was Mark, John Mark we find later, who accompanied Paul and Barnabas on their first journey, wrote the book of Mark. All sorts of other things happened. This is the one they're talking about. And they find many gathered there praying. And when he knocked on the door of the gateway to the house, they've described the house as not a typical bungalow, but a house that had a gated wall. So there's a front gate, and then there's the interior, there's a courtyard. So it's a very nice place, a big place. He knocks on the door of the gateway, and a servant girl named Rhoda comes to answer. They didn't have the little peephole that are in hotel rooms. They didn't have those back then. And it's the middle of the night. And she hears the voice, and she recognizes Peter's voice. Recognizing Peter's voice, and I love this very innocent phrase. In her joy, she didn't open the gate. She could have left him there. Maybe she just felt she couldn't, or she was so excited, but it says in her joy, she's like, oh, it's Peter. And Peter's sitting on the outside, hello. Hello, anybody there? She ran in, reported that Peter was standing at the gate. Now, it's the middle of the night. The people are not sleeping. They're praying. They know that the next morning, Peter is going to be executed. They have probably have an all-night vigil, if you want to call it that. They are gathered together for the power of asking God for an answer of some sort in some way. And she comes and says, hey, Peter's outside. And they said, you're out of your mind. She goes, but it is him. It's his angel. Peter continued knocking. When they opened, they saw him and they were amazed. He motioned to them with his hand to be silent. In other words, they probably all shouted. Not a good idea when you're on the lam from the Roman soldiers. He shouted and said, motioned to them with his hand to be silent. He described to them how the Lord had brought him out of prison. He said, tell these things to James and to the brothers. Now, let's make sure we don't mistake this James for the other James. We're on verse 17 of chapter 12. The other James is dead. He's already been executed. Peter knows this. This James is James, the brother of Jesus, who's the head of the Jerusalem church, the one who wrote the book of James. So let's make sure we don't mix the two in the same story. They are two different people. It's like having multiple Herods and multiple Caesars. There are multiple James, just like there are, well, there's only one Steve. Anyway. You know, I worked on that joke, and you guys didn't laugh at it. Anyway. So he says, tell the church. And most likely, James and the brothers are the same people that Peter had been talking to at the beginning of chapter 11. When after visiting Cornelius, he then went to Jerusalem and reported to the church. And the church was upset that he was with a Gentile. And then they said, oh, we see that God is opening the message to the Gentiles, and they accepted it. That's James and the brothers. And then it says he departed and went to another place. This is the last time, other than chapter 15 of Acts, that we see Peter again. Just says he left. We don't know where he went. There's a lot of theories. Some suggest he went up to Antioch, where the church was building and growing. It could have been he stayed there in Jerusalem and stayed in hiding, because Herod's out for him, as we see in the next verse. When the day came, the sun has risen, there was no little disturbance among the force. Sorry. I'm a Star Wars fan. You've got to realize, you know, you've got to inject it into the Bible a lot. Anyway, there was no disturbance among the soldiers of what had become of Peter. He just was disappeared. After Herod Agrippa searched for him and couldn't find him, it says, he examined the soldiers. I'll let you fill in what the examination looked like. It wasn't a talking sternly and asking them what happened. It was probably torture. And then ordered that they should be put to death. Was it just the four who were on watch that night, or was it all 16 of them? We don't know. Herod Agrippa was not really thrilled with this. And so Herod just left town and said he went to Caesarea and spent time there. The timing of this, and we know, we can pretty much figure out exactly what time of, in the chronology of the New Testament, when this happened. Josephus says that Herod left Judea to go to Caesarea for a festival that was being held there to honor Caesar, Caesar Claudius. And let me, I think I have the right, yeah. So he goes up there for this festival. There's a whole bunch of people there from all over the region, including, and we'll see in the next verse, including people from Tyre and Sidon. It says, Herod was angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon. It's like a non sequitur. Why? We were just talking about Peter. Now, why are we talking about Herod and his frustration with the people of Tyre and Sidon? Well, it's to kind of close the story on Herod. You see, a few years earlier, King Agrippa, Herod Agrippa, attempted to rebuild and fortify the walls surrounding Jerusalem. The governor of Syria, Gaius Vibius Marcus, objected to the spending, the expenditure, and objected with a letter to Emperor Claudius. Claudius told Agrippa to stop building. So he did. Agrippa spent time in Tiberias, a city by the Sea of Galilee, and entertained several kings from cities within the within that bordered Syria. Well, Marcus, the governor of Syria, approached the city. Agrippa wrote out to meet him in the company of all the kings. Marcus assumed that Agrippa was going to try to kill him. So Marcus urged each of the kings to go home instead and not show up for the meeting. Agrippa was very angry and marked Syria as his enemy. Remember? So we have Agrippa's in charge of all of this. He's not in charge of Syria. Caesarea is about here. Tyre and Sidon are up here in Syria. So he's kind of at war, political war, with the governor of Syria. So now Agrippa comes up to Caesarea for this festival for Emperor Claudius. The governor from Syria is there. And so what you have delegations from Damascus, Tyre, and Sidon, and they are coming to Herod asking for help because of the famine. See how this all comes full circle? We were talking earlier about the prophet saying there's going to be a famine in the land during the time of Claudius. We have Paul and Barnabas collecting money in Antioch, bringing it down to Jerusalem to help the people in the area. Now we have the people in Tyre and Sidon. They're hungry too. And they come to Agrippa saying, where are we going to get our food? Agrippa's not happy with them because they dissed him in some political fashion. And you end up with, they came to him in verse 20. They came with one accord and persuaded the king's chamberlain with a great name called Blastus. Name your kid Blastus and see what happens on the playground. I mean, come on, blast us. Anyway.
Sure, I'll bring it in.
Exactly. Blast us. Well, they asked for peace because the country depended on the king's country for food. On the appointed day, Herod put on his royal robes, took a seat on the throne, and delivered an oration to him. And the people were shouting, "The voice, it's the voice of a god and not a man." And immediately an angel of the Lord struck Herod down because he did not give the God the glory, and he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. Yummy. A lovely thought. Well, here's a little more of the story found in Josephus. This is a quote. Agrippa came to Caesarea, where there was a festival. On the second day, he put on a garment made entirely of silver linen and came into the theater early in the morning, at which time the silver of his garment reflected the sun's rays so resplendently to spread a horror among those gazing at him. His flatterers exclaimed he was a god, saying, "Be merciful to us, for although until now we've reverenced you as a man, from now on we regard you as superior to moral nature. You are a god." Right here in Acts. So he pretty much timed it perfectly. He wore a silver robe that suddenly he's a glowing light in the middle of the theater. All the eyes are on Herod. The king neither rebuked them or rejected their impious flattery. However, he looked up and he saw an owl and understood that the bird was a messenger of ill tidings. Suddenly and violently, a severe pain rose in his stomach. And he looked at his friends and said, I, whom you call a god, am commanded now to leave this life while Providence reproves the lying words you just said to me." 5 days later, exhausted by stomach pain, he died at the age of 53. Now, billions of theories of what killed him. Bottom line is, God did. Okay? God took him out. This was his consequence of his sinful actions, especially towards the church. But if you want to talk practically, the best one that I was able to find is that he had appendicitis that turned into, is it peritonitis, complicated by roundworms. Roundworms can get up to 16 inches long. They infest the intestines, block it up, it makes it really bad. And you know, if you're an appendix person, you got those in your body too, it's over. And it's excruciating pain. It's interesting that in Josephus, he describes the death of Herod the Great, Agrippa's grandfather, almost identically. Herod the Great died of great stomach pain. And there are the theories that it was the roundworms. Because you think of the king's lavish lifestyles and, you know, what they would eat and the corpulent nature of their, they're just big and bloated and they didn't, you know, treat the food properly. And those worms could get inside and really tear them apart. Also interesting, if you think about it, that means there's a genetic disposition to this problem. Because there's some people who could eat the same stuff and never get roundworms. Whatever their body rejects it. But the Bible just says here, verse 24, and it's set apart even in your text, not just on the handout, but in your Bible text, it's set apart as the Word of God increased and multiplied. Chapter 12 begins with Herod killing James. Chapter 12 ends with Herod dying. Closed. Herod Agrippa is no longer an issue, no longer a problem. Now there's Herod Agrippa II. That's the one whom Paul is brought to trial against. So it's Agrippa's son that we talk about later. So further confuses the issue. Not only have multiple Herods, but now we have multiple Herod Agrippas. So just go with it. You'll be fine. And then verse 25 brings us all the way back to the end of chapter 11. Barnabas and Saul returned to Antioch from Jerusalem after they had delivered their money to help the Jerusalem people, Jerusalem church, because of the famine. And they brought back with them John Mark, who we saw introduced earlier. We covered it. Amazing. Next week, we will actually start the first beginnings of the journeys of Paul and his missionary journey. But you can see here, let me just close in prayer. I don't want to overstay. Lord, thank you for our time. We explore all these historical details and yet seeing how your hand is involved in not only the history of the Jews, but the history of the Romans and the history of the people and their rulers and the Herods, and how it all comes together, how even the famines in the land contribute to the show of your sovereignty over all things and in every way. As we move into our time of worship, let us meditate on this, let's think about it, and let us praise your holy name. In Jesus' name, amen.